From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, those open lines. Here's what's happening. Well, still yet another theory is taking shape about what might have happened to the missing Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, something James Sanders and I have been thinking about and talking about since this disaster has occurred. Maybe it landed in a remote Indian Ocean island chain. The suggestion, it's only that at this point, they say, is based on analysis of radar data revealed by Reuters, suggesting that the plane wasn't just blindly flying northwest from Malaysia. Reuters, citing unidentified sources familiar with the investigation, reported that whoever was piloting the vanished jet was following navigational waypoints that would have taken the plane over the Andaman Islands. They had an earthquake out that way today, by the way. The radar data does not show the plane over those islands, but only on a known route that would take it there. And everybody still is baffled. James Sanders, of course, has been writing this story since it occurred. He's the author of The Downing of TWA Flight 800. James, any change yet on your thoughts that this may have landed somewhere?
Oh, absolutely. I reached out today for information late this afternoon, early evening. And, well, first of all, they landed in those little islands. That's just nonsense. And the outer edge of the big circle where it could possibly be, that's equal nonsense. That plane is fully capable. Keep in mind that you give up speed, you gain distance. It's fully capable of reaching Somalia, the badlands of East Africa, or Iran, although I personally favor Somalia. But what I picked up late today, interesting, I was kind of halfway mulling it over in my own mind, but then when I reached out to an intelligence person that I knew, retired, but who keeps his finger in, and he mentioned that his old partners and agency they used to work for, that they would be putting everything they possibly could into two things, two scenarios. One, we already are getting more and more confident that a highly sophisticated operation stole that plane. That would put it past Al-Qaeda and into something truly well-funded and extraordinarily hard to detect. The other would be, what's the most powerful thing that could be put aboard that plane where it landed to do the maximum damage to, and I'm guessing here, I didn't get this from any intelligence person, Tel Aviv, the southern part of Manhattan Island, New York, Washington, D.C. I can't think of anything stronger than a nuke, but I don't know if that is possible. You know, so, but that's, you know, to do the maximum damage in one of those three locations.
Would we see this plane take off if it were somewhere in Somalia or some other place? Would we eventually see it in the air and spot it?
Well, if they keep their sensors, you know, they move their satellites. And I have no idea if they have any ground ability or that kind of stuff, human intelligence or not, but in that area. But if they keep everything there, then they probably would. If they don't, then no. If they don't see it taking off, then there's a real good possibility it can get out over the Atlantic past the 200 miles where land radar can track it and simply buddy up with a plane headed for, without that plane knowing it, headed for wherever their destination was. If it was to the United States, if it was to Israel, then it'd be a little tougher to secretively buddy up with a plane to head to Tel Aviv. But in any case, it just depends on the professionalism of the group. You know, this is a hypothesis, not the absolute, you know, because they say still, it could still be a group that was pretty darn good, but not quite good enough. You know, and they find the plane out of fuel and on the ocean bottom.
That's right.
Yeah.
We can't rule that out by any means. But I'll tell you what, we know one thing, James, since you and I have been talking about this thing for a week now, that this plane veered off course by hours, and it was done intentionally. This was not an accident. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. That is as close to 100% as you can get. And the hours they're talking about are getting longer and longer and longer. They're now up to 5 hours and 59 minutes that they believe they have evidence that it continued in the air. Now, so that's going to stretch out if events continue. There's one thing that's going on. I have no idea whether a truthful statement will be made. You know, what was going on, some kind of electronic thing, and it may or may not have been the Rolls-Royce engines, it probably wasn't, was sending a pinger out, and whatever closest satellite picked it up, then the next satellite picked it up, kind of like how your cell phone is when it's turned off and you're driving down the road. It hands itself off.
That's
from,
right.
from tower to tower. Well, the same thing happens. You don't know exactly where the plane is, but you can get, you know, you can make an educated guess within some distance, you know, the direction of travel. It'd be a rough estimate, but it'd give you a little better guess of where it might be. That kind of information is apparently, according to a story that just announced Saturday over in Asia now, and so a story that came out about 7 o'clock Saturday morning over there added that information, that somebody over in American intelligence said that they expected to have finished that analysis within a couple, 3 days. That to me seems awfully slow, but better late than never. But after that, it's strictly, okay, if we don't find it on the ocean floor, then we have to prepare for the absolute worst. And so to do that, you've got to put your intelligence, overhead intelligence, anywhere where you truly think, not the garbage you feed the press, but where you truly think it in all probability is.
And I still haven't heard much about the pilot or the pilots. They're not saying too much about them. I wonder, James, if they've been to their homes or apartments, investigated, talked to their families or friends. Because this, to me, remains very strange.
I think so. There's a couple of Malaysian papers, English-language Malaysian papers, that I check twice a day online. And there's enough information in those papers to suggest that, I don't know if the government's been there, but the media has certainly been there. But somebody's been there and either fed it to the media or the media went and got it on their own account. But so far, nothing strange on those two.
All right. Now, since 9/11, these cockpits have been very difficult to break into.
Right.
I want you, and again, we're speculating here. We both agree that this plane was controlled by someone. We
right.
don't know who yet. But let's assume for a moment that these two people who stole the passports, or some couple, at least one or two other people, passengers, somehow made their way to the cockpit to take over that plane. How did they get in there? I thought everything was just, you know, so boarded up these days they couldn't do that.
Well, let me back it up a step for just a second here. First of all, we know beyond any doubt that enough power was inside the passenger cabin to control the people long enough to collect their computers and cell phones. We know that because no calls were made, and there would have been calls up the gazoo come flying out of that plane if they hadn't collected those. So there was enough power to keep people from even trying to use their cell phones.
And collected. What do you mean by power? You mean by firepower or force? Okay.
Potential force. You know, if you don't have to go beat somebody up if everybody thinks they're going to get beat up, you know, and you have that instant terror and the crowd kind of hunkers down and hopes they're not going to be the target of anybody. And
yeah.
So they managed to, obviously, get all the cell phones, and I'm sure that they put them in bags and put them up in the cockpit behind the big door. After that, you don't necessarily, and that would take a number of people, you know, not just one person
that's,
going down
that's
the
a
aisle
big
asking
plane.
Politely.
Yeah. Asking 227 passengers, 12 crew members, 239 people,
right.
You know, to give me your cell phones, that's a pretty big job.
That's a significant potential force that must be demonstrated. So you have to add quite a number of people to this.
Okay, but let's assume then that they have those phones, they've got that. Still, you haven't gotten into the cockpit to convince these pilots, give us this plane.
Well, and for this discussion, we, of course, assume that the pilots aren't part of it.
Aren't part of it, exactly.
Yeah. So, and consider that this is kind of the, by American standards, what we consider the backwater of the world. So they might not be quite as up to speed on things, but I'm sure their doors are. But there's a couple of things that can happen there in terms of passing the food in and out and using bathrooms and flight attendants going in and gabbing with the pilots and those kinds of things. And, you know, anytime that door is open, somebody in first class or, you know, people in first class can within, you know,
seconds,
less than two
yeah.
seconds be inside the cockpit.
That's true.
Yeah.
All right, James, let's keep our eyes on this one. Again, one of the most perplexing stories we've ever seen. James Sanders, the downing of flight. TWA Flight 800. U.S. officials announced plans to relinquish federal government control over the administration of the Internet, a move that pleased some international critics but alarmed some business leaders and others who rely on the smooth functioning of the web. So we're going to be giving up that kind of control. Not good. In Alexandria, stomach virus closes a school there. 230 kids get sick. Not good. Restricting the number of fast food outlets around offices and homes could help combat the obesity epidemic, according to researchers. Exposure, they say, to too many pizza and fried food outlets can nearly double your chances of obesity. Just a little news you can use. A new report on GMOs, genetically modified foods, that calls in the United Kingdom for field trials and fewer restrictions. They actually want, this is what they're recommending, let's go for some new trials and see if these GM crops are good for us. A lot of people in Europe aren't too happy about that. So what's it like to laugh, huh? The science of when we laugh and why. Up next, Scott Weems joins us. His book, Ha! We'll talk with him in a moment. I almost chuckled on that on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Scott Weems' career began as an officer in the U.S. Coast Guard, where he served as a communications officer in Kodiak, Alaska. Scott's travels then took him to New Orleans, Boston, L.A., Annapolis, Little Rock, earning graduate degrees in psychology, education, creative writing along the way. And he's got a Ph.D. in cognitive neuroscience from UCLA. His book is called Ha! The Science of When We Laugh and Why. Scott, welcome to Coast.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I've got to tell you, the title itself just caught me really had me chuckling. Good job on this, by the way. And, you know, so many people send text messages to each other these days now, and they always put in H-A, you know, ha, or L-O-L, or things like that. But tell me, how in the world did you even conceive of doing research on laughing?
Yeah. First, thank you for the kind words. And yeah, it's funny that it took me a while actually to realize that you can make a living studying and understanding humor. When I was in graduate school, I was interested in humor and I read about it, but I didn't think I could make it my sole topic of study because, I mean, this was sadly quite a number of years ago. It really wasn't a respected area of study, and it is a little bit more now. Still not as much as I think it should be. But it was really only in the past maybe 10 years or so that scientists are studying it full time, and that they're not just studying humor and language or humor and memory, but they're realizing that I think humor is on line with things like problem solving and intelligence and the special things which make us unique as a species.
Well, it's so important, I think, to laugh. I think it's healthy if you do that. Not a lot of people laugh a lot these days, Scott. How come?
Yeah, it's kind of a shame, isn't it? I think, first, everybody laughs. The degree to which we laugh varies. I think one study measured in the average number of times is about 15 and 25. One person laughed about 50 times in a day. One person laughed just once. So we all laugh some. But laughter is kind of seen as not a good thing, and this is actually historical. As you can go back to Plato, Plato outlawed humor and laughter in his Republic, saying it was frivolous. And then you can even use the Bible as a measure. Somebody actually counted the number of times there was laughter in the Bible in the Old Testament, and it was 29. And all but two instances were not positive. In other words, they were laughing out of scorn or derision. And so I think we have a very long history of not respecting humor. And I mean, you can see that it still is present today, and that it's been a real long time since a comedy has won Best Picture at the Oscars. In fact, you might even say it's never happened.
That's true.
I think the closest might be Forrest Gump in 94, I think, but I mean, even that's, it could easily be called a drama.
I have a couple jokes that I tell at the various events when I speak all over the country, and next weekend I'm going to be in Boise, Idaho, and I've not been there before, so I'm kind of thrilled because I can use these two successful jokes because this audience has never seen me before do this. But it's interesting that I can tell this story in various cities, Scott, and I know it will bring the house down because it's that funny. And you could judge it, and you just know. Why is that, that you know that some particular aspect of a story will do that, and another one just won't?
Yeah, isn't that funny how, I mean, even just very subtle changes in a joke can make it fail. I mean, it kind of takes practice to be able to get that joke right and get it to connect. But when you do get it to connect, it'll connect pretty universally. And I think it's because humor, really, I don't think you can look at it as something following a formula or something that just is isolated to the stage. We laugh at a lot more than just jokes. I think it's really a universal psychological coping mechanism. We every day deal with conflict and ambiguity in our lives. That's unavoidable. And the brain had to have a way in which it evolved to respond to that conflict. And laughter seems to be it. So, I mean, I think we all laugh, and it's so universal. And you can pretty much count on a laugh if you're kind of connecting with people, because we all have this difficulty in dealing with our surroundings. And difficulty, I don't mean in a negative sense. I mean it's not simple. No aspect of life is, and that's why we laugh.
And physically, what is a laugh, by the way? I mean, when you think of it, it's kind of a weird little thing, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, what's sad is this is not terribly understood. There have been people who have studied laughter quite extensively. And interestingly, I think the greatest progress has been looking at laughter in animals. Because we can understand that a little bit better. As part of my research, I interviewed a man who tickles rats for a living.
That's funny.
It is. I love that. That was my favorite part of writing this book. His name is Dr. Jeffrey Bergdorf from Chicago, and that's what he does. He tickles rats. And at first, this might seem trivial, because you know, first, what do you get really from learning that a rat laughs at roughly 50 kilohertz, and you can tickle it by rubbing its belly? But it's very important research, because what he's doing is he's trying to understand depression and trying to come up with ways to treat depression in humans too. And if you understand what makes a rat laugh, and you know, kind of get at the what happens in their brains, then you're getting a start for what happens to people too. And so for him, you can look in the brain and you can see their specific region, or for both the rat and the human, you can see there are specific regions of the brain. We call them the anterior cingulate and the dopamine reward pathway. And it gets a little technical, but we can kind of isolate the brain regions responsible in all animals for laughter.
And I think what's funny about that too, it's not the rat that laughs, but the guy who's doing it to make a rat laugh. That to me is funny.
It is. And he said it takes some time to learn. It's not easy. I guess it shouldn't be. I don't know why it would come naturally to tickle a rat. But he says you got to kind of get it on its back and you kind of rub its belly like you might a baby or a dog. You know, if you have a dog, that sometimes they'll do that. And they'll respond to that tickling the same way like a baby or a person would. They'll laugh before the fingers actually make contact. They'll run to tickling fingers. It's funny.
Well, with Scott Weems' book, Ha! Scott, I'm convinced that the intelligent designer of us knew just about everything, and every aspect of why we do what we do has been created, programmed. There's a reason for it all. So what's the reason for laughing?
I think there definitely is a reason for laughing, and it really is because if we didn't have laughter, I don't know how else we would respond. Who is it? I think it was Friedrich Nietzsche who said, man invented laughter because he suffers so much in life that he had to have some way to cope. And I think that's, in a way, what it is our brains are so frequently conflicted or so frequently confused. I mean, think about a computer as a comparison. If a computer gets overwhelmed or confused, it crashes, and you have to reboot it. Now, fortunately, we don't occasionally just fall to the ground and need to be rebooted. I mean, we're people, we can't do that. And so what our brains have come up with is a system of dealing with that conflict. And again, there's specific brain regions that kind of tell us, hey, there's something here that's not going on, that's not making sense. Sometimes that not making sense is a surprise punchline. Sometimes it's much more surreal than that. So it's, for example, maybe laughing at a funeral or something like that.
Yeah, right. That's right. I want to ask you about that, Scott, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Scott Weems with us talking about his work, huh? About what people do, how they laugh. Scott, you mentioned something about how some people will laugh at a funeral. What is it about people that, you know, somebody trips, let's say, on a curb and you laugh, or they walk into a plate glass window and because they didn't see it, and people laugh. Now, it's not funny. I don't think people are laughing because they think it's funny, but they laugh anyway. What causes that?
Yeah, there's a great line. I think it was Mel Brooks who said, if I walk in a manhole and fall in, it's funny, but if he does it, it's a tragedy.
Yeah,
and you're right. We do laugh at some pretty awful things. But really, it's a little more tricky than that, because if you think about it, take, for example, the TV show Jackass, Johnny Knoxville, where he gets hit by things, he gets hit by cars, and just terrible things happen. Now, people laugh at that because there's the understanding that even though some of the actions are quite violent, that there's no actual intended harm. And so there's basically a juxtaposition of this kind of casual, we're just having fun, with the, oh my goodness, somebody just got hit by a car, which is why if I went out and did some of these things and just hit somebody with my car in the parking lot, I would, you know, it would be a felony. I would be arrested, and rightfully so. But when you see this kind of slapstick or this kind of, I don't know, physical humor of people almost being hurt, as long as there's no intended malice, we laugh because it is kind of a weird mixture of violence and levity. And I think that's sometimes why jokes don't succeed. I take, for example, the Oscars, I guess about a week ago. Some of the jokes there, there was one in particular where I think Ellen was making fun of Liza Minnelli, and it didn't go over so well because there wasn't the lighthearted, she's my friend follow-up. And instead, there was only one message, and it was rather cruel.
Yeah, you know, you're right. There's nothing worse than a well-intentioned joke that falls flat, because then you're out there hanging.
Absolutely. And, I mean, you can think this is a little bit farther back, but Michael Richards, who played Kramer on Seinfeld, he got in quite a bit of trouble several years ago, and rightfully so, because he was being heckled and he made some racially offensive remarks.
Sure,
and I think, I can't get inside his head, I think at the time he was trying to be funny, but he clearly failed. And I think that's because people actually believed, you know, assumed that he believed what he was saying, and I think he might have. And that's not funny at all. And if he had maybe tried to make it some broader statement about racism in America, maybe he might have not been seen quite so negatively. I don't know. It would have taken some work.
How many times do people laugh on the average each day?
Yeah, it's amazing. Quite a number. I think several dozen times a day. I think one person was observed to, I think, laugh 48 or 49 times in a day. It depends on a lot of things. It depends on our gender. Women laugh more than men. And we know
really?
This because scientists have gone out and eavesdropped on people, coffee shops, subways, you know, wherever people congregate, and counted. And two women speaking to each other will be twice as likely to laugh as two men. And if a woman is speaking to a man, the woman will be laughing more. Regardless, actually, who's doing the speaking, the man or the woman, the woman will laugh more. And these are, of course, generalizations. But statistically, they come out to be pretty strong.
And have you ever gotten to a point where you laughed so hard you almost started to cry?
It is funny how sometimes those are connected, aren't they? Yeah, it's a very strong emotional experience. And we sometimes think of these emotions as separate, but they aren't really. And if I think good proof of these emotions not being separate comes from horror movies, because a lot of people love horror movies. And at first, this might not make sense because horror movies bring out emotions that we spend the rest of our lives mostly trying to avoid. But the people who enjoy them, studies have shown that not only do they feel the same fear as everybody else, people who love these movies, they also get joy from them too. So without being too nerdy or technical, there's a term for it. It's called cathexis, which is the opposite of catharsis, which most people have heard of. Catharsis is the cleansing of emotions. Cathexis is the opposite of that. That's the full experience of many emotions at once. It's the rich emotional experience of life. And I think that's what humor taps.
Is laughter infectious?
It is, quite a bit, actually. It might be one of the most infectious things there is. Just standing by somebody laughing will pretty much make you laugh. And studies have looked at this in all sorts of ways. And that's, I think, why they have laugh tracks on comedy so frequently, is because if we hear someone laugh, we want to do it too. The only catch, and this is very interesting, is that if we know somebody's laughing just to try and get us to laugh, in other words, trying to trick us, we don't laugh. So it has to be genuine for us to be able to share that laughter with someone else, which I think is why laugh tracks are not as popular now as they might have been 5 years ago. It's like we've figured out the trick.
You know, in relationships too, Scott, you know, generally I've found that the guy that can make the woman laugh, he's got a good chance of taking that girl out.
Thank goodness for people like me who are not movie stars. There's a hope for all of us if we can learn to be funny. And that's absolutely true. If you ask women what's the number one thing they look for in a man, sense of humor tends to come out number one. For men, it's closer to, I think, number three after intelligence and looks. But still, we look for sense of humor. And I think there's a good reason for it, because really humor is linked with a lot of things. It's linked with intelligence and problem-solving ability. And there have been a lot of studies to show that just having a good sense of humor is a sign of good fitness. You know, somebody who you kind of want to have as a mate and will help you have good children and raise those children. And so it could be that we look for sense of humor in our partner because it shows that this is somebody who is worth the effort.
Is there a science behind laughter, Scott?
There is, and it's really only recently that we're getting to look at that closer. And I think it's about time too, because laughter is just such a big part of our lives, and it's so important, and it has so much benefits to our health and intelligence and things like that. I think we can not just do simple things like. There have been a number of scientists who just do things like measure the amount we laugh and look at the circumstances we laugh. But I think we can understand the psychology behind why we laugh. This is what I'm most interested in. And this is difficult.
How about other cultures? I mean, do you find that folks in India will laugh as much as folks in Iran? Does that happen?
It is, and I think that's a great thing, is everybody laughs. It doesn't matter what culture you are, who you are. There's variation, of course, but every culture, laughing is universal. And in fact, there have been studies have shown that like babies will laugh even if they've never seen it before. So it's not something that is learned by watching your parents do it. You are hardwired to laugh. I think that's a beautiful thing. Aristotle said that we don't get a soul until we laugh, and that's about our 40th birthday, as in day, you know, our 40th day. And that's about when babies start to laugh. So, yeah, I think laughter is a great thing, and it's nice that it ties us together. Now, different cultures do laugh at different rates. It's much more valued in the United States than elsewhere, which is good for us. Here in America, we're very fortunate that we're in the laughter capital, but everybody does.
Now, what does it tell you about the humor? The person that has a better sense of humor, generally, what will their personality be? Will they be more outgoing, better in business? Does science tell us that?
It does, and this is where the science gets a little weird, actually. So hopefully this isn't bad news for people who fancy themselves as fans of humor, but people who are good at telling jokes, it winds up where they show slightly higher rates of two personality traits. One is neuroticism. And that kind of scares people at first when they hear that. But it's not a bad thing necessarily. Neuroticism actually exists on a spectrum from either being very stable to very neurotic. And so just because you show hints of neuroticism doesn't mean that you have something wrong with you. But one study of British cartoonists, which was interesting, showed that successful cartoonists, funny ones, and other professions too, they have higher levels of neuroticism. And the second thing is also higher levels of psychoticism, which is related, but this is a little bit more of a in-your-face, aggressive is probably not the best word, but assertiveness, I guess. And so we see people who are not just successful in comedy, but also other areas of their life, they have to have some of that edge. Without a little bit of edginess and anxiety that you see with these two traits, you don't tell good jokes. So it helps if you're a little, just a little bit off balance.
Tell me about this episode that happened in 62 in Tanzania.
Yeah, this is fascinating. And it amazes me that so few people have heard of it. This is what we call the laughter epidemic of Central Africa. And it occurred in a place called, it's Tanzania now, it was Tanganyika at the time. And it started with three schoolgirls who started laughing. And then their friends started laughing. And then their friends started laughing. And soon over 1,000 young girls were just laughing uncontrollably, and they couldn't stop. Which at first sounds that's odd, but it lasted a year and a half.
A year and a half of laughter?
A year and a half. I know, it got passed on, so, one girl might stop laughing and another one would start. But this was a serious outbreak. I mean, that would be painful to laugh for that long. And so this was shocking, and nobody knew what to do. So they tested the water, they tested the food, they did whatever they could to try and identify what might be happening, and they couldn't figure it out. So in the end, I think it really comes down to, it would be easy to say that it was like a nervous breakdown, a collective nervous breakdown, but it's more complicated than that, because the girls, they had to shut down the schools, and the girls eventually stopped laughing, but like I said, it was a long time later. But at the same time, they had just switched from from British to African local rule. They had just desegregated the schools, and they had just switched from a tribal to a more Catholic and Protestant-based religion. So they were undergoing massive social change, and I think the girls didn't know who they were anymore. It was just too drastic of a change for them, and their brains did the only thing that could figure out what to do, and that is laugh for a very long time.
The trait of laughter, what does that tell you about the individual? Are they more creative? What do they possess?
People who laugh, are they more creative?
Yeah.
I like looking at it the other way, because are people who are creative, do they laugh? And it works both directions, I should say. I think so. Studies have shown that if you, for example, just watch Robin Williams stand up, after that stand up, you will be more creative. You can take a creativity test or perform an insight task, tasks that get your brain going. And you'll do better on those tasks after watching the comedy than if it had been a documentary or a drama or something.
Tell me about the case of the man who ridded himself of a disease by laughing.
Norman Cousins, what a great guy. Yeah, he actually had a disease. I think I'm going to butcher the name, but ankylosing spondylosis, I think. Anyway, it's a collagen disease.
Nobody would know about it anyway.
So I know. Okay. Well, hopefully not. It's a collagen disease. So basically the joints connecting his bones was falling apart. And the doctor said, yeah, I'm sorry, there's no recovery from this illness. And his medical care he was not satisfied with. So he locked himself in a hotel room and started laughing. And he laughed hours a day, every day, and just made a point of watching comedies. And even though he had been told that he had pretty much no chance of recovery, pretty soon he just laughed himself out of the illness, which is amazing. And he wound up living several dozen, or at least a couple dozen years after that, a nice full life. And he credits laughter for his recovery, that basically it was a positive attitude and just the exercise of laughter that helped him get past this tragic disease. And I think we can all, there's enough benefits of laughter that have been found, and I think he was probably, there was some truth to that, that he actually did get benefits from it.
The people who write for like the Tonight Show and for David Letterman and Jimmy Kimmel, the writers itself, and they're always trying to look for humor and something funny. What makes them so creative, Scott? How do they do what they do? I mean, it's not easy to write out a joke, especially for somebody else.
No, it's not easy. It's incredibly hard. And I think if you were to ask them, I'm not sure they could give you the answer either. It is. It's. I like to think of humor, I'm obviously biased, but I like to think of humor as on par with, you know, painting and sculpture and a number of arts that there's a saying that being successful requires following the five P's, and that is practice and practice and practice and practice and practice. And I think these people who basically do comedy for a living, they understand humor, but they've practiced it a lot too. And in some ways, that's a shame because it makes it seem like humor is out of the reach of, you know, people like me or you or whoever's not necessarily a professional comedian. But fortunately, exposure is enough that gives us the benefit. To get to the level where they're at, to be able to write and just do genius comedy, I think we could possibly do it, but we would have to dedicate our lives to it. And I don't think I have the time, and probably you don't either, to be that skilled, I guess.
When comedy bombs, it's really bad. Really bad. And so why does one person think it's funny, the writer, let's say, but the audience does not?
I know. How tricky is that? Actually, for my book, I wanted to apply what I had learned and try stand-up once, and I bombed. I mean, I wish I could, like, lie and tell people it was great. It wasn't. I mean, I had my moments, but for the most part, it was bad. And it's because it takes more practice than I've given it. And it's hard to know if it's going to succeed or fail. And I think that's because I think humor is a psychological process, and what works for me might not work for you. And I think part of that has to do with the edginess issue we were talking about before, that humor has to be a little edgy to succeed. But everybody has a different threshold. So what's edgy for me might be grossly offensive to someone else, or vice versa. I might be more sensitive. And so that edginess, you've got to find, I guess there's a sweet spot. And there actually is a sweet spot. Researchers have shown that humor with too much edge, too much cruelty, that's out of bounds. We don't enjoy it. And there's a whole history of things like dead baby jokes and stuff like that are in that too far category. And then there's the humor that's too passive, and we don't really laugh at it. This is what's brown and sticky? A stick. It's funny, but you know, people don't, you know, few people are going to call that their favorite joke ever because it's not.
I'm still trying to get it.
Yeah, what's brown and sticky? A stick. There's not a whole lot to it. It's not worth dissecting too much. It's an example of one that's a pretty tame joke, and it's not going to get people very excited. So you kind of have to hit that sweet spot.
How come on some days one is in a good mood, and another day they are not? What happens to them there?
Oh, wow. That's so tricky to try and break down. And we know humor is tied with a lot of just our hormonal cycles, our daily cycle. There was one study that looked at the funniest joke in the world, had people rate their favorite jokes and over the internet. And from that, I think they had over 1 million jokes judged. And from that data, they were able to see how humor varied by time of day, day of the month, and things like that. And it wound up where people enjoy humor the most in the evening and during time of their life when there's fewer work deadlines and things like that. So it might just be that our sense of humor really varies with how much anxiety and stress we have in other aspects of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
That the more relaxed we are, the more ready we are for that surprising punchline or turn of the joke. And that would make sense, I guess.
Can you determine the outcome of a child's personality by their humor when they're little?
Huh, that's interesting. You know, I know the sense of humor.
I think you can.
I think you probably can, too. I know even children as young as 10, you can see a relationship between humor and intelligence, and you can kind of tell what the humor of that child is going to be. And there was a really fascinating breakdown where some people followed famous comedians for quite a long time and tried to find out what was special about their childhood. What is it about comedians that makes them want to pursue that line of a career and, you know, be a funny person? And it turned out there was one thing that, I mean, first, everybody was different. So there was 100 different paths to being a comedian. But there was one thing that was shared, and that was a desire to be heard. To not basically fade into the background. Every comedian, every person who embraces humor feels that they have something to say, and I think that's important.
That is. So we're going to take some phone calls with you next, Scott, when we come back. Questions for Scott about laughter, or if you want to share a story of some funny event and see how that ties into what we're talking about tonight. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.